The folks that I'm going to be talking about tonight are some really amazing individuals. Has anyone here ever heard of Battlefield Airmen? Okay, a few. How many people know what the Battlefield Airmen are? Okay, that's good and bad. It's bad that we all don't know about them more, but that's good because you're here and I'm going to tell you about the Battlefield Airmen. They've been around for a while. They just haven't been called Battlefield Airmen, and I think that many of you are going to recognize what they are and what they do from what you already know about air power. I'm going to start off with a slide that really will make you think about the Air Force. It's the kind of image that you would expect to see when you think of the United States Air Force. That is the Air Force. That's a Battlefield Airman. And I'll talk a little bit more about this picture in the context of it, but I think this is part of the reason why many people haven't heard of the Battlefield Airmen. They're a small group, and a lot of the missions that they do are classified. Their missions are esoteric. This is what the Air Force says that they do. They provide distinctive expertise in a ground combat environment with unequaled firepower, accuracy, responsiveness, flexibility, and persistence. That's clear, isn't it? I'll put it in kind of regular language here. Basically, Battlefield Airmen are a link between the air and the ground. The issue of who's responsible to take care of missions that involve the ground and the air at the same time has been something that the Air Force, the Army, sometimes the Marines have had some pretty heated discussions about over the decades, especially after the creation of the U.S. Air Force. It's not a situation where the ground just stops and the air begins. It has to be seamless. So there has to be people with knowledge of the U.S. Air Force, its capabilities. There have to be those people on the ground, and that's essentially what Battlefield Airmen do. They work with conventional forces, so regular Army units. They also work with unconventional forces, SEAL teams, with special forces, Green Berets. And also, too, another key component of the Battlefield Airmen is that they operate beyond the airbase. This is not patrolling the perimeter of the airbase. This is behind enemy lines. This is at the front lines. It's in a ground combat environment. An important thing about Battlefield Airmen is that what they do is it's the Air Force's responsibility. As you listen to the presentation here, you might find yourself saying, well, can't the Army do this? Or I wonder why the Army isn't doing this. Or maybe are there people in the Army that are doing this job? And the Air Force has very clearly stated what the Battlefield Airmen do is the Air Force's responsibility. It's part of the Air Force's roles and missions. And I hope that through this presentation I'll be able to kind of illustrate why it's an integral Air Force capability. Some of the things that Battlefield Airmen do include reconnaissance, surveillance, weather reconnaissance, airfield survey, battle damage assessment, air traffic control, terminal attack, which essentially is guiding weapons in and giving clearance to release ordnance to pilots, personnel recovery, and field trauma care. They do a lot of different things. Another thing about Battlefield Airmen is that it's very, very complex, the way that they operate, the places that they're at, how they operate. So I'm going to generalize some of those things as I go through this presentation, but if you have questions afterward, I'll be glad to answer them if I can. Also, another thing that Battlefield Airmen do is a lot of classified work. So with recent operations, there's a lot that they've done that I have no idea of, and no one with a clearance, and no one that has a, if someone doesn't have a clearance and a need to know, they don't know either. So I'm sure that as the years go by, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now, we'll find out some things that they're doing now and that they've done in the last 5 years. The Battlefield Airmen are many things. They're mostly enlisted members. Maybe 10% or so are officers, if that, and the rest are enlisted. That's a characteristic of the Battlefield Airmen. They're small in number. There are a little over 3,000 Battlefield Airmen in the Air Force right now. The Air Force has looked to up some of those numbers in certain areas, but one of the problems is it's very demanding, and I'll explain why as we go through here. They're highly motivated volunteers. They're not forced to go into these career fields. They have to want to be in them, and they have to work very hard to get their specialties. They're also extensively trained, and I'll talk a little bit about that as we go through. And not surprisingly, they're in absolutely excellent physical condition. Now, this exhibit that's going to be open, it's going to be opening at the end of the summer or early in the fall. It's going to go near the B-1. And I've been working with several of the battlefield airmen over the course of the last year and a half. And I've been very fortunate in being here and meeting so many amazing people, just so many amazing people. And I'm sure all of you know what I'm talking about, the speakers we've had come here. I've met folks who've donated things, pilots, air crews, ground crews. I've met Medal of Honor recipients, Air Force Cross recipients, some really amazing people. And I have to tell you, with working with these battlefield airmen, with that said, of all the people that I've met, these are really special individuals. I'm so impressed with them because they have so many amazing characteristics all put together in individuals. They're incredibly physically fit. When I've told some people about some of the battlefield airmen I've met, I've said, well, yeah, they have shoulders 6 feet wide. And I'm kind of exaggerating, but they are incredibly physically fit. And in addition to that, they are so intelligent. They have to know so much. Their training is so extensive. So physically fit, very intelligent, and they are highly motivated. And there's certainly many of them are risk takers. It's really not a surprise. But it's amazing that all this is put together in one individual and that we have so many individuals like that who are the battlefield airmen in the Air Force. More specifically, the battlefield airmen fall together in roughly four groups. And there are some subspecialties within those groups, but there's basically four. Pararescuemen, the PJs, I'm sure many of you recognize that name. Combat controllers, maybe not as well known. They're also known as the CCTs for combat control teams. There's the tactical air control parties, also known as TACPs. And then the battlefield and special operations weathermen. Another thing about the battlefield airmen is that this concept of calling them battlefield airmen altogether is a relatively new thing. It started, I believe, as 2005. So even though these specialties have been around for quite a long time, as you'll see, they have not really operated so much together. And that's the idea of the battlefield airmen, is that there's common training needs, there's common equipment needs, and so the Air Force recently had this concept of battlefield airmen to try and kind of unify and streamline the equipment, developing the equipment, where there's common training, and things of that nature. Well, the first group, the pararescuemen, the PJs, have the motto, that others may live. And we have several exhibits throughout the museum about PJs. Probably the most obvious one is the one that's in Southeast Asia War. But the PJs were around even before Southeast Asia. And basically their mission is to do personal recovery in peace and war and in all environmental conditions. And the thing about the PJs is they're often known about their combat rescue, but they have saved thousands of lives in non-combat situations because of their specialty, because of their abilities. They're also skilled paramedics. And so you have these situations maybe in peacetime where there's an individual who needs trauma care, but they're on the side of a mountain or out bobbing in a ship out on the ocean. There's only a limited number of paramedics who can get to that scene. So in addition to combat search and rescue that the PJs do, they're also used quite a bit in peacetime. The pararescue began about the same time that the Air Force was created, actually just a little bit before the Air Force was created. And there had been some rescue jumpers used in Canada and the China-Burma-India theater during World War II, but they were not really pararescuemen. So it was first formalized in 1947. And the PJs really got a lot of attention in the Southeast Asia War. That was probably the first conflict where they really became known, and primarily in rescuing downed air crewmen, even some in North Vietnam. And as I've written there, the majority of the Air Force crosses that were awarded in Southeast Asia to enlisted Air Force personnel were to the PJs, and they were absolutely amazing. And again, they're volunteers, extensively trained, and they knew what they were getting into. Also, too, there's the Pitzenbarger Medal of Honor. He was a pararescueman. So the PJs have a long history that goes back about 60 years. Also, too, they are authorized to wear a maroon beret. So if you see an Air Force person with a maroon beret, they're a PJ. The next group, the combat controllers, their motto is first there. Their mission is to control air traffic in remote locations, to set up austere airfields, and to direct paratrooper assault drops. The thing about the combat controllers, though, is they're, because they are so skilled, they're used in a lot of other ways, particularly special operations and with special tactics units. In addition to these abilities and this mission, they also have several other missions. Their history does go back to World War II, and they trace it back to the Pathfinders that were used for paratrooper drops. There was a problem with the first combat drop that we had. We didn't have these Pathfinders, and the paratroopers were scattered all over the place. And so the idea was to have individuals drop in before the main assault came in to set up radio beacons. And I'd certainly encourage you, when you get a chance, over by the C-47 is the paratrooper mannequin. And in that mannequin case is one of those radio beacons. So that really is the start of combat control. Not too long after that concept of the paratroop pathfinders was instituted, then they came up with glider-borne, actually called combat control teams. And they came in gliders with even more equipment, and that was for the follow-on waves. And that was used operationally in Operation Varsity, which was the operation across the Rhine in 1945. But the thing about the combat control teams is that they were used in World War II. The war ended. The Air Force said, this is our mission, this is our mission, this is our mission, and telling the Army, this is our mission. And they got the mission. And then the Air Force kind of didn't put a whole lot of effort into it. They wanted to make their point, it's our mission, but they didn't do much with it. But then with the contingency operations, and there were many in the 1960s, and then the Southeast Asia War, the combat control did get a lot of support and then started to grow. So they really came into their own in the 1960s. In particular, during the Siege of Khe Sanh, during the Southeast Asia War, for those of you that are familiar with it, there was a base that got surrounded and pummeled by the enemy. And the only way that that base was gonna be kept from being overrun was from the bravery and the fighting of those who were there, but in addition, the resupply and the air support from the Air Force. And there were Air Force combat controllers there who were guiding the transports coming in. They were guiding drops of parachutes or parachute-borne equipment. And I've talked to a few of those guys that were there, and they were under constant fire, and they were living just like the Marines were at Khe Sanh. So that's an early achievement of the combat controllers. Also, I failed to mention, with the combat controllers, they're certified air traffic controllers. They don't just kind of know how to move airplanes around. They're certified air traffic controllers. The next group is the tactical air control parties. They have kind of an unofficial motto, death on call, and it's appropriate. Their primary job is to do something called terminal attack, and basically that's to call bombs down on the target. And that's a tremendous responsibility, because if they call the bombs down on the wrong target, it's very easy to kill friendly, to have fratricide. Also, too, if the bombs they're calling down are not in the right place, they're not going to be effective. They could also risk air crews unnecessarily. As a group, they're called ROMADs, and that comes from early in their history when the title was Radio Operator, Maintainer, and Driver. Well, that really doesn't hold true now, so they've come up with another group of words to fit the acronym because they're very proud of that title, ROMADs. Now they call it Recon, Observe, Mark, and Destroy. Some of the ROMADs, after a certain amount of time, at least 2 years, they go through additional training, and they become something called JTACs, which is a Joint Terminal Attack Controller. And that's the person that calls down the bombs. That's the person that gives approval to the pilot to release the bombs. That's the guy who makes the call. Their history goes back to World War II with Jeep-borne forward air controllers, particularly in Europe, supporting Patton's drive through France and also in Italy. An important thing about the JTACs, though, is that they're enlisted. And for those of you that might be aware of it, the Air Force was very particular about giving that authority to enlisted for a long, long time. In Korea, there were these TAC-P units. In fact, we have a TAC-P Jeep over by the T-6 in the Korean War Gallery, and it's an amazing story. I'd encourage you to read that as well and take a look at it. But with the TAC-P Jeeps in Korea, the forward air controller was an officer. And then there was the ROMAD, and basically that person was an enlisted who took care of the radios. Of course, they weren't nearly as reliable back then as they are now, took care of the radios and basically drove the Jeep around. Well, in the 80s, with some shortages, the Air Force decided, okay, we're going to hand this over to only some of these TAC-P personnel. They're going to have to be extensively trained, and it was something of an experiment. Well, it worked great. And they were called ETACs at the time, Enlisted Terminal Attack Controllers. And just recently, in the last 3 years or so, they were renamed JTACs, but they did the same mission. But that said, the important thing to remember is that these are enlisted giving this authority, which was a big step in the Air Force's history. And the last group is the battlefield weather and the special operations weather. And they also trace their history back to World War II. They operated, they called them combat weather in World War II, and they used them in the China-Burma-India theater and also in Europe. And the battlefield special operations weather, their motto is Weather Warriors, and they're essentially in two groups. There's the battlefield weather, and they work with conventional Army units. And then there's the special operations weather, and they work with special operations, Green Berets, with the SEALs, and other special operations units. And basically what they do is they provide mission-tailored meteorological forecasts and observations, and they're right there. And in spite of the technology that we have with weather forecasting, with satellites and things like that, there's still a need to have somebody there on the ground, a meteorologist on the ground. They can go anywhere in the world, just like with these other battlefield airmen. So those are the four groups. And then the battlefield or special operations weather, they're authorized to wear this gray beret. And when the exhibit is done, I'm going to make sure that these berets are on this display and explained, and also their insignias, their emblems, because all these groups are very proud, and rightfully so, of their own individual heritage. For the lecture tonight, I had intended on talking about the training for each of these groups, but it is very complex, and it really wouldn't be fair to you if I went through every single training course. But that said, I did think it was important to just mention some of the training that they go through. The battlefield airmen, they don't go through all of the same training except for a certain core competency. They all have their specialty training. For instance, the combat controllers, they get air traffic control training. The battlefield weather, obviously, they're meteorologists. They get training in that. The pararescue get extensive training in trauma care, much more so than a basic first aid. So they all get their own areas of specialty with their training. In addition, any of these battlefield airmen that work with special operations forces, they all receive special operations training. They are just as trained up as a SEAL or a Green Beret if they're operating with them. They're not extra weight, they're not visitors, they're not guests, they're part of the team. So some of the training that that the battlefield airmen go through include airborne training, and which would be with like the 82nd Airborne, 101st Airborne. They receive basic paratrooper training. In addition, some of the battlefield airmen learn combat parachuting training, which is something called HALO. where they drop out of an airplane, sometimes they're so high they have to wear oxygen, and they free fall until they get to low altitude, and then they pop the parachute, or it's popped automatically with an altimeter. Some of the battlefield airmen receive combat diving training, just like the SEALs do. They get scuba training. They learn how to dive down to about 130 feet. So most of them receive survival, escape, resistance, and evasion training, also known as SERE or SEER training, obviously, because they're working behind enemy lines often. Those that work with the special ops receive the special tactics training, like I mentioned, and then, of course, they all receive weapons training. So these are really not your typical airmen. I mean, and also, too, many of them, or most of them, are not typical infantrymen. I mean, they're trained beyond. They're trained to drop in the middle of the night from the air, or come in from the sea, or rappel down a helicopter. I mean, really is amazing. This is in addition to their specialty training. Oh, one other thing, too, really quickly. One of the problems with having the numbers be up so that each career field is manned at the level that the Air Force would like is, how do you find people who can get through the training? How do you find people that are physically fit, that have the intelligence, the motivation, the drive to get through it? It's really very difficult. I use one example with the PJs. At one point, the washout rate was 90%. It's down to about 60% that I last checked now. So, and these are people that, the ones that wash out, they volunteered to go and try and do this, and for whatever reason, their bodies can't take it, or they decided they didn't want to do it, or what. And I've only included a few photographs here, but these are absolutely and utterly punishing. The picture on the upper right, I believe that's at the end of at something like a 20-hour exercise, and these guys have been running around for hours and hours. They haven't slept for almost a day. And in this exercise, they have to lay on their stomachs and do flutter kicks, something like 200 flutter kicks after this 20-hour day, at the end of this 20-hour day, with a face mask that's full of water. I mean, it's just incredible what they have to go through. And this is just to get their basic qualification to go into these career fields. And then the real challenge begins. They go out into the world. I'm going to talk a little bit about basically what battlefield airmen have done recently, excuse me, in Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan and in Operation Iraqi Freedom in Iraq, and then I'm also going to talk about two specific engagements. Now, again, like I said, much of what the battlefield airmen have done in the last 4, 5, 6 years is classified, and I don't know. In addition, they're out there right now, and not just in Afghanistan, not just in Iraq. The Air Force really does, and the military depends on their services. So, but I want to pick two engagements and talk about those just so you get some idea of what they're doing and what they're able to do. This picture here, there's an individual that you may recognize right there. That's Hamid Karzai. And that is in very late 2001 or early 2002. And I think all of you, without much thought, remember how we all felt at the end of 2001 after 9/11. And Hamid Karzai was very promising for us in Afghanistan. But we were worried that the Taliban was going to kill him very quickly, because they knew that we would want to get his support. So they sent in special tactics teams into northern Afghanistan, which the special tactics team included not just Air Force battlefield airmen, it also included Navy and Army. And they got to Hamid Karzai. They helped him out. The Taliban was going against him and his northern alliance, but they helped him out. They brought in air power, and they also protected him, as you can see here. So, and in that crowd, some of those individuals that you're looking at there are battlefield airmen. And I've actually talked to one of the battlefield airmen who's in that picture. He's going to be donating clothing that he wore at that time. So that's really exciting. And that will be on display. So even right off the bat with Operation Enduring Freedom, battlefield airmen, which is modus operandi now, is they're there sometimes I mean, either right at the beginning of the conflict or as early as they need to be there. Like the combat controller motto is, first there. The conflict in Afghanistan, because of the terrain and just because of the nature of the conflict, has led to some somewhat unusual situations. The forces there are somewhat light in certain areas. There's a heavy dependence on air power. So you get this situation where you see these unbelievable pictures that just don't seem to make sense when you look at them, like this one I had shown earlier. That's a satellite antenna, and that's a JTAC, and he's working with a special tactics team. I don't know his name, but I know what his role was. And they found in the mountains that vehicles didn't get around very well, but the locals were using donkeys, so why not hook their satellite antenna to a donkey? I mean, it really is amazing to look at that image. That is real. In addition, this is a combat controller right here. I do know who he is. This is Master Sergeant Bart Decker, and he went in very early in Enduring Freedom. He was in one of the first waves, and again, it's the same situation. You know, it was a lot easier to get around on a horse. So, and this individual here is Sergeant Ramon Colon Lopez, and he's now the commandant of the PJ school, and he is absolutely a that's something too, is that with these battlefield airmen, the word hero is thrown around an awful lot, but so many of these battlefield airmen are really, really heroes. The situations that they get themselves into by volunteering are astounding, and Colon Lopez is one of those. He really is an amazing person, and he's going to be helping us out with the exhibit as well. And he's going to be donating the clothing that he's wearing there, and that's him in Afghanistan. Many of the battlefield airmen in Afghanistan let their beards grow and wore some local clothing. It just made things a lot easier. They didn't stand out nearly as much. So you get these situations that maybe look a little less than military in the pictures, but they are absolute consummate professionals. Another thing about Afghanistan is that the terrain, with it being so mountainous, the forces absolutely have to be mobile. And also it allowed Al-Qaeda and Taliban elements to hide. And battlefield airmen were then, in 2002, and are still now in the mountains of Afghanistan hunting the terrorists down. And they have bring the ability to the word leverage air power has been used so many times it's really kind of tired, but it's really the right phrase to use. They leverage air power. So they're these very small groups of individuals, and they can bring down unbelievable firepower precisely. And it's something that an unmanned aerial vehicle just can't do. It takes someone on the ground to be able to call in the fire that precisely. Another thing that the battlefield airmen have done in Afghanistan is to help guide in humanitarian drops. Many of those were in 2002. Now, in Operation Iraqi Freedom, the battlefield airmen, again, as in Afghanistan, were an essential part of the Air Force's mission in Iraq. They provided close air support all over the place. Many of you may have recalled on that initial drive at the beginning of Iraqi Freedom, it seemed like things moved pretty quickly, and then occasionally forces would get bogged down here and there. Battlefield airmen were there to call down firepower. There were some airmen that were downed. Some aircraft that were lost in Iraqi Freedom, and there were PJs that pulled pilots out. They also helped, the PJs also helped with wounded Army personnel. They used some Air Force helicopters as medevac because, again, the PJs are trained paramedics. Also, too, there were combat controllers that located, identified, and called in forward assault strips. And then there was another thing that battlefield airmen did right at the beginning of the war, and they were working as part of special tactics teams. They were with Army special operations personnel, but they conducted operations that paralyzed 11 Iraqi divisions. They fooled the Iraqis into thinking that there could be attacks coming from other places other than where the main attack was, so they froze 11 divisions. Now imagine if those divisions had been arrayed against our forces coming up from the south. We still would have won, but we could have lost a lot more people. So Battlefield Airmen were part of that. And again, up till today, Battlefield Airmen are in Iraq right now, and they're extremely important because air power is very important in Iraq. And in one of the engagements that I'm going to talk about, you'll see how important their role was in leveraging air power. I do want to make one point, though, that there are other Air Force boots on the ground, if you will. And this is absolutely nothing to take away from what these other Air Force personnel are doing in Iraq and in Afghanistan, because some of them have lost their lives in the performance of their mission. Some of them have been grievously wounded. But there is a difference between battlefield airmen and what some term expeditionary combat airmen, to kind of try and separate the two groups. A lot of it has to do with really how do you train and equip these individuals? What individuals have similar training and equipment needs? Because that goes to logistics and training and the use of scarce resources. So some of these other Air Force boots on the ground include OSI agents, Office of Special Investigations. These individuals are going out, they're apprehending people, they are tracking down terrorists, and they're in the streets of Iraq, and they have been. And we've lost some of the OSI agents. Also security forces. Many of us think of security forces as being only on the base, but in Iraq, security forces have been used to patrol neighborhoods, and particularly in neighborhoods that are around our air bases, but also in other places too. So they're out there on patrols as well. There's air liaison officers. And what the air liaison officers do is, in addition to the JTACs, the air liaison officers are also called ALOs. They are rated airmen. They're pilots, they're navigators, weapon system operators, they're air crews. And for 2 to 3 years, they're on this duty as ALOs. And what they do is they work with conventional Army forces, and they are, whatever that unit size may be, they're that Army commander's primary air advisor. But these ALOs are also authorized to do terminal attack control. They can call in weapons. But oftentimes, they're with the Army commanders, and they're also commanders of the TACP, the Tactical Air Control Party units. But typically, they're a little further back from the front lines. Not always, but oftentimes they are. And the thing with the air liaison officers is that it's a 2 to 3 year stint, and then they go back into the airplanes. So they're not doing this as a career. You know, this is a relatively short term thing. And finally, there's the convoy escort. And there have been thousands of airmen who've performed convoy escort, which you know, we've all seen the news. It's a pretty dangerous job in some places. They're called ILOs, or in lieu of, and it means they're doing work in lieu of their specialty, whatever it may be, aircraft mechanic, personnelist, you know, whatever their Air Force career might be. So all of these groups are in the fight, and they're boots on the ground. It's just that their training and their equipment is not the same as the battlefield airmen. So, but you may see some of these individuals in the news or have read about them. I think it's very important that they're not overlooked or ignored. So, and the museum has been collecting artifacts from all of these groups. We have artifacts that have come in from all of these groups. So eventually, hopefully, someday we'll have exhibits that will explain about what these individuals are doing for us. I'm going to talk about two engagements in particular, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. One is at the very beginning, not too long after 9/11. The other one was last year. I picked them, one in each country, and that they're so spaced apart in time, to try and give you a sense of there's a lot going on in between those dates, and it's still ongoing now. These are just two examples. So it's not as if there was heavy combat in the first year, and then everything's kind of tamped down, and everything is, the Army's doing it, and the pilot's up in the air. The battlefield airmen are engaged. The first engagement I want to talk about is it was on a mountaintop in Afghanistan, and the name of the mountaintop was Takhar Gar, and it was renamed Roberts Ridge. Now, I'm sure many of you have probably heard this. Some of you have maybe heard the story of Roberts Ridge. but maybe not with the emphasis on battlefield airmen. This engagement really kind of brought the battlefield airmen to light to a lot of people. Many people who had never heard of the battlefield airmen heard of them for the first time with this engagement at Taker Gar. It was in March 2002, and it was in eastern Afghanistan. And now this picture, this is not a picture of Taker Gar, but this is in the same area. So you get some idea of the problem. I mean, you can see there's a valley in between two mountaintops. I don't see any roads. The tops of the mountains are snow-covered, and this is really difficult terrain to get around in, and it's really ideal for the enemy to hide in. Again, like I'd mentioned earlier, we all remember how we felt after September 11th and how we really wanted to see things taken care of in Afghanistan. And there was an offensive called Operation Anaconda. And Anaconda was very important. There were large numbers of Al-Qaeda right on the border with Pakistan, and there was a concern that they were going to slip across the border. So there was an idea to do this operation to find, trap, and destroy these Al-Qaeda elements. And the operation really depended a lot on air mobility. And the idea was it was going to be a kind of like a hammer anvil attack. There would be blocking forces, and then other forces would come in, trap the enemy, and smash them against these blocking forces. Well, this is where the area was of Anaconda, right here. This is Pakistan. This is the border with Pakistan. So it was literally right on the border with Pakistan. Here's a close-up, and I'm not going to go through every little detail of this map, but there are a few important places here. There was a place called Objective Remington, right in here. This is a mountain ridge. These red lines were the assumed escape routes for the enemy. There was a land component coming up the valley. There was an air mobile component that would come in here, and you could see that they would fix the enemy in here, and there were several blocking places. All these little T's were all blocking areas. But for the purposes of this engagement, the important area was Objective Remington, right here. This is a relief map. There's Objective Remington right there. And a force was to come up through the valley, and the enemy was all through in these mountaintops. And when the engagement, operation started, Anaconda started, forces were moving. They got somewhat bogged down on this valley, the land forces. So the command authorities decided, okay, they already had observation teams all over in the area that had been pre-planned, where these special forces teams would go in strategic locations and lay low, not get observed or anything, and they would have these vantage points. And as they saw the enemy move around to counter our moves, they would call in airstrikes. They would also call in to report the enemy's position so our ground forces could counter them. Well, it was decided that on this mountaintop, Taker Gar, there was a need to put in a reconnaissance unit, a small reconnaissance unit. And it turned out it would be a SEAL team with one Air Force battlefield airman in it. But if you look at this, Taker Gar is at 10,200 feet. The mountaintop peaks go up to 11,000. Actually, in some spots, they go a little higher than that. So Taker Gar was not the highest mountain peak in the area. That would become important as things developed. On that SEAL team that went in was also this individual, Technical Sergeant John Chapman. He was a combat controller. He had been in the Air Force for several years, and a lot of times with these special tactics teams, like I'd mentioned, they bring in a battlefield airman because that individual can leverage air power, and not just Air Force air power. They're familiar with Navy air power, Marine air power, coalition air power, Army air power, the helicopters, the capabilities of those systems, with surveillance systems, satellite systems, on and on and on and on. So they really bring an awful lot to a small team. This is a picture of Taker Gar. Now, in this picture, it would seem that Taker Gar is the highest peak in the area, but it was not. I don't know if this picture was taken from a higher mountaintop or from a helicopter, But if it was taken from a helicopter, I still think it would be, it's a good illustration of that there were other vantage points nearby. On that that little dark blob there is a helicopter. This was taken a day after the battle ended. Well, the SEAL team with John Chapman on it, they went in to land on the 2nd of March in 2002. So again, this is not that much longer after 9/11, maybe 6 months or so. And it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, local time. So it's dark out, and they oftentimes operate at night. They have night vision goggles and other sensors that really give them an advantage at the nighttime. And the aircraft was, or the helicopter was an MH-47E. It was a specially outfitted Chinook, and it had the code name of Razor 3. Well, as they were coming in, intelligence hadn't picked it up, and they didn't realize that that was actually a fortified position. There was a heavy machine gun that was there, and also they had RPGs, they had AK-47s. It was somewhat of an entrenched position. So as they were coming in and coming into land, and just as they were about to touch down, they were hit with RPGs. They were hit with heavy machine gun fire. And in fact, as they were coming in, the pilots were talking to each other. They just didn't, something didn't seem right, and they were talking about actually aborting. And they were still kind of talking about it when everything went loose. Well, there were a couple of SEALs that were just ready to jump out the back of the Chinook. They were just ready to go, and so they weren't hooked in. And so when the helicopter got hit, and when the pilots applied power to try and pull out, one of the SEALs, Neil Roberts, slipped on the ramp and fell out. Now, he only fell about 10 or 15 feet, so he was not mortally injured when he fell. The helicopter had been hit so badly, the pilots barely had control of it. There was no way that all they could do was to try and keep from tumbling down the mountainside, and they crash-landed the helicopter about 7 kilometers down in the valley, and it was kind of a controlled crash. So they couldn't just stop and pick Roberts up. They had to try and keep from rolling down the mountain. No one is exactly sure what happened to the Navy SEAL, Neil Roberts. He did fire back, but he was mortally injured, and he did die on that mountaintop. But you can imagine what his team must have felt as they were down at the bottom of the mountain, knowing that he was up there because they took a head count. And so what happened after that was they called in what happened, and there was another helicopter which had landed another team in another location, which was in the air. They diverted. They'd already dropped their team off. They diverted, and they went down into this valley. And the team, numbering now 5 SEALs and the combat controller, said, take us back up there. We're going back up there. Now, they were way, way outnumbered, and they knew it. But they couldn't wait for another team to come in because they wanted to try and save the other member of their team. So they jumped on this helicopter, and it's another MH-47E, and they went up, and as they came in, then that helicopter got hit very badly, but they were able to get off the helicopter, and then that other helicopter just kind of limped away and went back to base. So these 5 SEALs and John Chapman were on the ground, and they immediately came under fire as soon as they came out of the helicopter, and a couple of SEALs got wounded pretty badly. Chapman went after one enemy position with another SEAL, and he killed 2 of the enemy. About that same time as they were taking that position out, another machine gun position opened fire, and Chapman turned to charge that position. That the team was getting wiped out, and he turned to charge that enemy machine gun position, and then he was killed. But as he was doing that, that allowed those remaining 5 SEALs, some of them wounded, to disengage and start moving down the mountain. I mean, they were so overwhelmed. So the SEALs didn't get wiped out, and part of that was due to Chapman's action. So it's really a mess by now. They've got one helicopter that's down in the valley. They've got SEALs on the mountaintop that are wounded. They've got another one who's probably dead, but they can't know for sure. And they're calling in reinforcements. So there was a quick reaction force. It was a 23-man quick reaction team composed mostly of Rangers. And their existence was to do pretty much exactly what they did. It was to be able to be a mobile, highly capable force that could go to whatever emergency might happen on the mountaintops. Well, this 23-man team included four Air Force battlefield airmen, and they could be loaded onto two helicopters. So there was some confusion at the time, not surprisingly, with what was going on in the mountaintop. It seems that it wasn't fully understood how many of the enemy were on that mountaintop, and that's easy to understand because in battle things get confused, and especially in the middle of an operation that was ongoing. Anaconda wasn't just in this area. It was in the general area, so there were other engagements going on. Well, these four battlefield airmen that came in that wave of reinforcements was Kevin Vance, Jason Cunningham, Kerry Miller, and Gabe Brown. And unfortunately, I couldn't get the photographs of Miller and Brown, but we'll get those in the exhibit. And I'm also talking with them about bringing artifacts in, so hopefully we have some artifacts to display to the public that comes through here and tell about what they did. Well, there was some confusion about where they should land. Now, the enemy who was dug in there on Takhar Gar had seen two helicopters come and land in exactly the same spot. So they're just waiting for them to come back. So there was some confusion, and rather than land a little bit further down the mountaintop, not in the valley, but a little bit further down the mountaintop, the first helicopter went to land in exactly the same spot. There was some confusion as to exactly where the enemy were, and it was thought that they were a little bit further away from Takhar Gar, and that's where they should land. Well, they landed right where two other helicopters had landed before. And they weren't even able to hit the ground before they got hit. They got hit by at least one RPG, maybe two, and they were hit by machine gun fire and by automatic rifle fire. And this did far more damage than with the other two helicopters. It put that helicopter down. In fact, that's the helicopter right there. And some of the air crew that were on that helicopter were killed instantly. Both pilots were grievously wounded. And then some of the Rangers were killed. Well, they got off as quick as when that helicopter hit the ground. Those that could get out got out. And a few of the Rangers were killed as they went out the back of the helicopter. So, again, they're overwhelmed. But they were fighting back as best as they could. Jason Cunningham on the bottom left there, he stayed inside that helicopter to treat the wounded, those that he could treat. Now, mind you, when he's inside this helicopter, There's bullets going through the helicopter. There's fire coming through. It seems counterintuitive to stay in a place like that, but that's what he was trained to do, and he was doing his job, even though it could have cost him his life. Well, he eventually treated those inside and pulled them out, and he created a casualty collection point. And now the second helicopter that was coming in saw what happened to the first helicopter, and they did not land. It would have been foolish for them to do so. What they did is they turned and they went down the mountain a little bit and landed maybe 1,000 feet down the mountain out of the fire so that the Rangers on board could climb up to that position. That was the wise thing to do. Well, as the firefight continued, the two PJs, Jason Cunningham and Kerry Miller, they created a casualty point. And this is a painting of Kerry Miller pulling one of the pilots to the casualty collection point. And this is an excellent illustration of what they had to deal with. The enemy had the high ground, and all they could do was duck down and try and return fire. They were outnumbered, and several of them were wounded. So this went on for hours and hours. Now, Cunningham kept, as people got hit, not just Cunningham, but also Kerry Miller and some others in the team. When someone got hit, they were exposing themselves to enemy fire and pulling these casualties to relatively safe locations. So Cunningham was constantly exposing himself to enemy fire, and they were able to push the enemy back somewhat. But a few hours after they landed, Cunningham was hit, and he was mortally wounded. But he continued. He patched his own wounds as best as he could and continued working on the other wounded until he died. Both Cunningham and Chapman were both awarded the Air Force Cross posthumously. And those are the highest awards that have been given to Air Force personnel in this century. And it's no big surprise that they were both battlefield airmen. Well, eventually they were able to bring in more reinforcements, and they were able to wipe the enemy out. And we did lose 7 Americans in this battle. The enemy was completely annihilated. And there were some lessons that were learned from Takhar Gar, which ultimately will save lives in the future. And one of those things is the battlefield airman concept and trying to get unified communications, unified equipment, and things like that. There is going to be part of the exhibit on Takhar Gar, and I hope to have artifacts from all these individuals. And it's very encouraging to know that what they did up there on that mountain in Afghanistan is not going to be forgotten, because there will be people coming through this museum. Millions of people will read about what they did, and not just now, but for years to come. This engagement is more recent. This is in Najaf in Iraq, and this engagement took place in January of last year. And it's really kind of difficult with, I think sometimes with the operations in Iraq, that it's kind of easy to tune out, that, oh, there was this firefight, there was this, and it just seems kind of a steady thing. But the battlefield airmen that are in Iraq right now are engaged in real combat. They're doing incredibly important work, and this is just one engagement. So as I go through this, recall that in Fallujah and in all these other places where there have been battles, battlefield airmen have been there, and they've been an important part of the fight. So this is just one example. I'll give you a little background on what happened in Najaf and why Najaf is important. It's a Shiite holy city. There's a mosque that's there that's extremely important to the Shias. And after Mecca and Medina, this is the next holiest city for the Shiites. It's also a destination for pilgrims, for Shiite pilgrims. So there are times where this city swells with pilgrims, which, of course, is an ideal situation for those who want to foment chaos. It's a city of a little over 500,000 people, although that number may have grown somewhat with some of the population shifts in Iraq. And there was a large battle with Sadr's forces in 2004. And if you recall, for the first 2 or 3 years of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the South was problematic at times. The Shiites were not totally organized, and we had some things to deal with in the South. And 2004, that came to a head in Najaf. But things had calmed down enough by the end of 2006 that security was turned completely over to the Iraqi security forces, to their police, and to the Iraqi army. And we did leave, however, some small teams of special forces in the area just in case. And this is a perfect example, too, as I talk about this. The battlefield airmen and special forces in general, but in particular battlefield airmen, they have the ability to have effects on the battlefield that far outweigh their numbers. I mean, it's remarkable. You know, these just a few individuals here can bring overwhelming air power down, and they, as you'll see in this, they can literally turn the tide of battles. Individuals can do that. What happened at Najaf in 2007 was that there was a report that there was going to be an assassination of some Shiite religious leaders during a Shiite festival, and so it was thought that the most problematic part was from this group that was called the Soldiers of Heaven, and they were compared by one person that was over there as kind of like the Branch Davidians at Waco, that they had this kind of end of times fanatical point of view about their faith, and they had thought that their imam was the next coming, essentially, and so they were ready to die. Now, what the Iraqi security forces thought they could do is they thought they could go there and arrest about 30 of them early in the morning, and it didn't seem like an unreasonable thing. They were going to come in and snatch some of the leaders, so that's what they tried to do. But what ended up happening was they didn't realize there were, instead of 30, there were about 800, and that they had been secretly fortifying this compound that they have. And when I say fortified, I mean full trenches, reinforced positions, heavy machine guns, RPGs, automatic rifles, and there were 800 of them. So this is kind of what happened to the Iraqi police when they showed up. They were immediately attacked and completely ambushed. They got hit by RPGs. They got hit by machine guns. And they were pretty much wiped out. Well, the call went in immediately to the Special Forces teams for help. And the first team that arrived, they didn't have any battlefield airmen with them. And they realized that they were outnumbered, but they didn't realize by how much, and through no fault of their own. Nobody had any idea that there were so many of these 800. So they did as best as they could, and then they called in another team. So another Special Forces team came, and this time there were two combat controllers that came along with them. Now, the combat controllers, the JTACs, or the Joint Terminal Attack Controllers, are specially trained to drop the ordnance or to call the ordnance in. Some combat controllers go through that exact same course that the JTACs do, so they're trained up the same way that they are, so they can call in airstrikes. Well, the enemy had mortars, they had truck-mounted heavy machine guns, they had RPGs, so the battle went on, and after a couple of hours, it was obvious that they were completely overwhelmed also. So they called in another Special Forces team, and also some additional security forces from the Iraqis. And on that third Special Forces team was Staff Sergeant Ryan Wallace. On the upper right there, you see what happened to one of the Humvees of the first Special Operations team that came in. And there actually is something of a happy ending to this. It looks terrible, but when that third team came in, there was Wallace said, well, let me try going around to the back and let me see if there's some other way that we can get in. You know, let me find out where all the fire is coming from. This is a pretty good-sized compound, though, and there are many, many insurgents, like I said. Well, they went around to the back of the compound, and they started getting fired at. So they ducked underneath a berm, and there was an Apache that came in. Now, mind you, through this engagement, these three combat controllers, they controlled strikes from F-16s, AC-130s, FA-18s, Apaches, AC-130s, Royal Air Force Tornadoes, and that's just what I can remember. So, I mean, they had this amazing mix of air power that was up above them, and some of the accounts from the pilots talk about, I've never seen the air so crowded. I mean, they were just itching to take these guys out. But the thing is, somebody's got to control that. Somebody's got to make sure that the bombs land in the right place, not on our people. And that's that. In this case, it was the combat controllers, oftentimes the JTACs, that are doing that also. So he went to the back of the compound, and they were calling it an Apache strike because they were getting shot at. And somebody was calling, oh, my gosh, they've got truck-mounted machine guns. And in the first part of this here, that's one of those machine guns. That's actually one of the ones that were taken out. It's essentially light anti-aircraft. It's like a 50 caliber machine gun or a 14.5 maybe. Well, there was an Apache that was shot down. And it went down right near the compound or in the compound, and they knew that the crew was dead, but they wanted to recover the crew. So while they were under fire, and another thing is they were getting shot at, two of the Special Forces, they got shot through their helmets, but thank God they weren't killed, but it knocked them out. It hit as they were trying to peek over the berm, their helmets got shot through, but it knocked them out, but it didn't kill them, and they eventually recovered. Well, at a critical point in the battle, there was a key enemy position, and it was this trench. And there were about 40 insurgents in it. And they were covering, you can see the machine gun right there, they were covering that machine gun. And so Wallace, along with two other Special Forces personnel, were about 100 meters away from that trench, and they couldn't get any further. And so Wallace was talking to a pilot, an F-16 pilot, who had never dropped a bomb in combat before, by the way. And was talking with him about getting the right mix, getting the right weapon to drop in. And they decided that it would be a 500-pound laser-guided bomb. And the pilot, you know, talking about, where's your position? You know, Wall said where he was. And the pilot was very concerned because he said, you're 100 meters away, And Wallace knew anyways that the danger zone for a 500-pound bomb is 300 meters. So he was within the danger zone. But he said, you know, we got to take this position out. Bring it in. So he called in the strike, and the pilot was Captain George Collings, and he dropped this laser-guided bomb, 500-pound bomb, right into the trench, absolutely into the trench. The trench absorbed the explosion, and those who were in the trench, it killed several of the insurgents that were there. And as Wallace describes it, as chunks of dirt were still flying in the air, they ran at this position. He and the other two special forces killed the rest of the insurgents. So they're running through these clumps of dirt that are coming down from this explosion. And that was the turning point of the battle. And an individual said that after that, they were not on the defensive. Up until that point, there were points in the battle where they were on the defense. He said after that, they were not on the defensive. That was the turning point in the battle. And the result of that is that of those 800 or so insurgents, almost half of them were killed, and most of them were killed by air attack. They captured more than 400, including 14 high-value targets. Those were some of the ones that they wanted to arrest, those that were still alive. And then that Soldiers of Heaven sect was completely destroyed. With all that happened with that, there were two Americans that died. But considering the ferocity of the battle and all the insurgents that were there and that they were dug in and the weapons that they had, it really is miraculous that was our casualty count. And a lot of that had to do with those three combat controllers that were there at Najaf. And then, so those are two engagements that have happened, one in Afghanistan and one in Iraq. And again, they're separated by 5 years. But those kind of operations are still going on. Battlefield airmen in Iraq, they're in Afghanistan. Anytime we have contingencies, Grenada, Panama, you know, whenever there's contingencies, there's battlefield airmen there. And they're serving the country very quietly, year in, year out. So the next time that you hear something that the Air Force does in a remote location or that the U.S. military does in a remote location, know that there are battlefield airmen that are there. Hopefully we'll be able to learn more about some of the things that they're doing as the years go by and the classification gets taken down. So, but in the short run, like I said, the exhibit's going to go up at the end of the summer or early in the fall. It's going to include all the things that I've discussed tonight, along with some other remarkable individuals and some of the heroics that they've done.